This week marks the 8th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. President Obama is considering a new approach in Afghanistan. This week, he's meeting with top policy advisors to discuss the direction of the war. General Stanley McChrystal, the commander of NATO's International Security Assistance Force, has asked the president to authorize sending up to 40,000 additional troops to Afghanistan. President Obama has already ordered the deployment of 17,000 additional U.S. military personnel, but he said he's not ready to make a final decision on further increases until he has a clear vision of the right strategy for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Joining us today to talk about the war is Dr. Andrea Rue, anthropologist, adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. She spent time in Afghanistan and Pakistan with Save the Children, UNICEF, and USAID. She's been a technical advisor for U.S. Agency for International Development Projects in the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa, and a research associate for the Harvard Institute of International Development. Her latest book coming out next month is Simple Gestures, A Cultural Journey into the Middle East. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we have Ambassador William Rue, who served in the Middle East for over 30 years. He's a board member of the Middle East Policy Council and the Public Diplomacy Council. He's an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and teaches public diplomacy at Tufts University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And then Sebastian Younger, author and journalist, worked as a special correspondent in Afghanistan, embedded with the 2nd Platoon Battle Company in the 173rd Airborne Infantry. He joins us from a studio at Radio Art in New York City. Good morning, Sebastian.
Good morning.
Well, the president is facing a tough decision. Ambassador Rue, what drives the policy of the governments of Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Depends on who you talk to. American intelligence and American policymakers, I think, are convinced that the Pakistani government is focused and has been focused for years primarily on India, and has supported effort in Afghanistan to prevent the Indians from getting a foothold there. I think it's interesting that just this morning we heard the news that the Indian embassy in Afghanistan was attacked. That will raise questions about Pakistan's overall policy. But the Pakistanis share the Pashtun tribes with Afghanistan, and they've supported the Pashtuns, and they've supported the Taliban and indirectly the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, primarily because their focus is on India. We have a different view of that situation. We wish they would focus on terrorism, on insurgency in Afghanistan. And we are concerned that they are taking their eye off the threat of terrorism and insurgency. They insist that they can handle it, and that's an internal Pakistani problem. And recently they've gone into Swat to deal with the Taliban there. But we're particularly concerned about the tribal areas in the west of Pakistan, where we understand the Afghan Taliban leadership, Mullah Omar, is, and they're supporting the insurgency from Pakistani territory into Afghanistan. And that's a main issue of contention between the United States and Pakistan. So we have serious concerns with the Pakistani policy. And complicating the issue is the Pakistani military intelligence, the ISI, which is to some extent, we believe, a state within a state, and it has so much power that the civilian government in Pakistan can't control it entirely. And it's an embarrassment to the civilian government of Zardari and Gilani in Pakistan, because the ISI is doing things in Afghanistan that we don't like, and we've complained about for years. And the Pakistani government has repeatedly told the American administration, going back for 20 years, that it's not really happening when we know it is. This started a while ago. during the earlier the Reagan and Clinton administrations, when we were helping, particularly during the Reagan administration, we were helping the Pakistanis deal with the Afghan situation by funneling money through the ISI, and that has become a Frankenstein monster, in our view. But the Pakistanis continue to deny that there's any real problem there.
It's a very complicated situation that we've got going on there. And you mentioned the Taliban's claimed responsibility for that suicide car bomb, that saying the target was the Indian embassy. At least 12 people were killed, more than 80 wounded. Also, a few days ago, we had a base nearly overrun in Kandesh. 8 men were killed. Similar situation to what happened last year and whatnot. And Sebastian, I want to ask you about this. The vulnerability of small bases, a big issue. What do you think? Are we seeing a change in strategy as far as holding on to these small bases?
Yes, I think the initial idea behind them, and it's a sound idea, is that if you're walled up in these huge bases, there's no channels of communication with the populace. And we have to go in there and convince local Afghans that we mean well. We can help them. We can build them schools. We can build roads. And you can't do that from behind walls in a huge base. So the idea was to put a lot of small bases out there where we could interact with the population and win over their hearts and minds and build bring projects in. The problem with that is that there really were not enough troops in Afghanistan. So these small bases were manned by 15 men, 20 men at times. And that made them very, very vulnerable. I was at a base that had 15 men at it. It was a two-hour walk from the nearest fire base. And had they massed enough, had the enemy massed enough men around us, they absolutely could have taken the position.
Yeah.
That would have meant everyone there died. That's a terrible, terrible situation for the U.S. military to be in. I think in the absence of massive amounts of more troops, they decided to pull out, and there is now a very conscious strategy to pull back from the small bases and put the troops in the centers of in the population centers. Right now, the small bases are in very deserted areas where they're very vulnerable. The idea is to concentrate in areas of Afghanistan where most of the people live.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into some of your experience in a second, but first I want to ask either Ambassador Rue or Dr. Rue, is winning hearts and minds a viable strategy?
Well, I'll try to answer that one. I find it a little difficult to imagine that we can actually win the hearts and minds of local people. I think generally tribal people focus on what their own interests are, and they may momentarily be interested in aligning with Americans, but if they feel that there's some benefit for them. But also, they're easily swayed by the threats of the Taliban. So I would think any attempts in this direction would be very difficult to sustain, partly because I think Americans lack cultural sensitivity in the area. And although I know they've worked very hard, the military, to try and make their troops more sensitive, it's almost an impossibility in the short term to do that.
We're talking about the war in Afghanistan. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Sebastian, we mentioned you were embedded with the 2nd Platoon. You were in the Korangal Valley, where they were constantly under fire. I saw some of the video that you got there, and this was at the forward point, most dangerous area in the country, constantly under fire.
Yeah, the one day that I was there, there were four firefights. The enemy trying to take the position that we were at. They were, about 50 meters away in the straw, right below the sandbags. It was very, very intense. They at one point, I think 20% of all the combat in all of Afghanistan was happening in this 6-mile-long valley, the Korangal Valley. It was just insane at times.
What were you hoping? You did an article with Vanity Fair, and I know you're working on a book and a film on this. What are you hoping? What's the message you're trying to get to people? What are you hoping for people to see with this?
Well, I've written a lot about sort of big picture politics, what should we do, what's happening overall in Afghanistan. I've done a lot of that, and it's a country that really I'm very fond of and I'm very concerned about. My idea for this project and for this book was to actually shed all of that. I wanted to understand the experience of a soldier, and soldiers, as a rule, do not think about the big picture. I think they can't really afford to. So what I did was I spent a year off and on with a platoon, 30 men, at this very remote outpost. I did five trips that lasted up to a month. And my what I wanted to do was just almost channel their experience, which does not include any political analysis. They really don't care what happens in Afghanistan. They really barely cared what happened in the next valley over. They were very focused on what happened in front of them at their outpost. And I think that's typical of soldiers throughout history. And I wanted to make the public understand what their reality was, good or bad. There's sort of no moral analysis here, but this is what it is. And that was my my interest.
Right. And to really understand this war, Dr. Wu, we need to look back on some history. This is an area of the world that's played a critical role in cultural development since ancient times.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And much of it's there are several things that actually affect what's going on today. And one of them in particular is the geography. Afghanistan is divided along the middle section, almost like a belt, by this very huge Hindu Kush mountain range. And over time, there have been invaders that have come in and either been able to cross it or have remained in the northern parts or have come in from the south. The Persians, the Greeks, the Turkic tribes, the Arabs, even the Mongols under Genghis Khan came. And now the Hazaras, who are often spoken about, are said to be remnants of these Mongol tribes. But the Pashtuns, of course, Karzai is a Pashtun leader, President Karzai, and the Pashtuns consider themselves the only true Afghans, and they claim to be companions of the Prophet. There are two sections of the Pashtun tribes, which are important because they divide in terms of elections and things like that. At the moment, out of the 368 districts that there are in Afghanistan, the Taliban controls about 140 of them. So that's quite a large number. The Sunni-Shia question is not so important as it is in Iraq. They're only the only Shia are basically the Hazaris. But to talk a little, just for a minute or two, to make some points about history. The Pashtuns have ruled Afghanistan for 250 years, ever since 1747, when an original Loya Jirga elected Ahmad Shah Abdali, the first king. And since then, this Loya Jirga has been the most important legal authority in the country. This is all important for what's happening now. Of course, another major happening was in the 19th century when the British and the Russians demarcated the Afghan border and left these Pashtun tribes on the east divided between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they've never accepted or ratified that particular border. Finally, this Pashtun rule came to an end in 1973, and after that there was a period of turmoil, and the Russians came in for a decade in 79 to 89. Another important time was after the Russians left. The leader of the Northern Alliance, who was a Tajik, came into Kabul in 1992 and took over the city. And that was the first time in 300 years that a non-Pashtun had ruled. And that caused consternation in the Pashtun tribes. And one of the warlords that the U.S. had supported and the Pakistanis had supported came in and bombarded Kabul and began a civil war that lasted until the Taliban took Kabul in 1996. Mm-hmm. So in certain ways, the Taliban were regarded as saviors in their intent to make a more peaceful Islamic emirate at that time.
Yeah. Well, Sebastian, I saw an interview where you talked about privacy. You visited Afghanistan in 2001, and I think you were comparing the difference in the greeting you as an American had from your you know early visits to you know as you went later in 2005 and whatnot. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what the difference has been?
Yes, I was there with Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, in 2000. And after 9/11, I went back immediately, and I was with the same committee. Massoud had been killed right before 9/11, part of the 9/11 plot. And I rushed back there, and I was with his commanders, the guys that I'd known from the year before, when they moved on Kabul with the backed up by the U.S. Air Force and took Kabul. And we got into Kabul. I was traveling in a group of four reporters, and we got into Kabul early in the morning, the first morning that the Northern Alliance forces got in there. And it was an extraordinary scene. The people absolutely felt liberated. And we were walking around. I remember a kid bicycled by playing a harmonica, and they were flying kites. They were obviously, very obviously doing everything they couldn't do under the Taliban. They had radios out on the street, and masses of people were dancing in the street, inconceivable under the Taliban. And people would find out that I was American, and of course they'd all watch the American bombers sort of do their work against the Taliban front lines. That's what allowed the Northern Alliance to take Kabul. They'd find out that I was American, and several times this happened to me. I would get hugged on the street. They'd say, "America, America." I mean, it was just a jubilant and joyous moment for them. And the role that the United States played in that moment, they understood very, very well and were incredibly grateful about it.
And has that changed in your visits after?
Yes.
Yeah. What is it like now?
It's
hard to tell because in the subsequent trips, I've been with the U.S. military, and the Afghans are guarded around the U.S. military. I've been on patrols and things like that. But just even walking around Kabul, the sense that I get is that we're a kind of necessary evil. I mean, it's sort of like the police in a high-crime neighborhood. Mm-hmm. People in those neighborhoods don't necessarily like the police. The police are capable of terrible mistakes and prejudice and everything else. But God forbid they ever leave. And I think the Afghans have settled into a kind of accommodation with us where they don't particularly like the U.S. military walking around doing whatever it wants, but they understand that if the United States pulled out, if NATO pulled out, it would be hell on earth in Afghanistan, and they don't want to go through that again. That's the sense that I have about their feelings towards us.
Any thoughts on that?
I think it's really hard for Americans to fully understand what would make the Afghans win the hearts and minds, as they say, of the Afghans. I can say that behavior is one of the important things. All these small actions that Americans take, their facial gestures, their modes of action, even their dress and various politeness behaviors that Americans are not totally sensitive to. And Sebastian, I'd like to say that I very much enjoyed your Vanity Fair article, but it told a lot about the troops. But I noticed that in the pictures that were there, the American soldiers who were interacting with Afghans were all bare-chested. And to an Afghan, this is a very rude thing. I mean, you wear clothing in order to respect other people, and no Afghan would go around with half their clothes off this way. And I'm sure it's perceived as rudeness and a kind of insult to the Afghans they're dealing with. So it's these kind of things that Americans are not even aware of that they do
I should explain. Mm-hmm. I should explain that. I mean, just quickly. They weren't going on patrol bare chested. They were in the outpost, and it was very, very hot weather. And the a truckload of Afghan in those photos, a truckload of Afghans had unexpectedly come to the outpost and met with the lieutenant, and they basically surprised the men in their positions. So that's not, I mean, that's not how they walk around.
Yeah, but they may not still have been aware, and you could see on the Afghan's face in the picture that he was rather shocked or surprised by this appearance of the men.
Sebastian, let me ask you, because you were with the soldiers, do they get any kind of training in that area as far as you know, the cultural differences, and, you know, do they talk about that at all?
They do. I mean, keep in mind they're 18-year-old, 19-year-old boys, so guys. So, I mean, I think the training is as effective as it is in trying to explain to a 19-year-old how to behave well here. You know, it's a difficult age. I also think there's some accommodation in the minds of the Afghans that, look, these are Americans. They're aliens. We could never hope to have them conform to our culture. They're in some sense a lost cause. I mean, I think there's a different expectation than if you were wearing civilian clothes in Afghanistan. At one point there was a mission that was done in the Korangal Valley. They were trying to develop, bring some economic development, and there was a young woman from that had been, I believe, sent by the embassy. I can't remember exactly what she was, but she came in with the military to speak to the locals. She was probably 30 years old, and she spoke to them in Pashtun, and spoke for about half an hour in Pashtun about what she wanted, how she wanted to help them bring economic development into this valley. And I don't know what the elders thought of it. It may have been so outrageous that a woman was speaking to them in their own language that they short-circuited. Or they might have been incredibly impressed that an American delegate took the time to learn their language. So you can't entirely typify America's interaction with them in one sort of blunt phrase. It's actually quite nuanced.
Yeah. We're talking about the war in Afghanistan. Our panel of guests are retired Ambassador William Rue, anthropologist and author Andrea Rue, and journalist and author Sebastian Younger. Our toll-free number, if you would like to join the conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Just a minute ago, Sebastian was talking about, you know, the kid with the harmonica in the street and the Jubans, all the things that you would see that wouldn't have happened with the Taliban in power. And we heard those reports of, you know, teenagers dancing to music, playing music, women going back to school. What's happened with that progress? Have we continued there? Have we regressed? What's going on that front, Andrea?
Well, I think we've regressed again, especially I think you can't talk about all of Afghanistan, because in certain areas where the Taliban hold sway, which, as I mentioned, are quite a number of areas, there certainly is a lot of control over the women, and where they maybe put aside their chadors at one point, they probably are putting them on now under threat of the Taliban. Also, girls' schools have been under threat in particular. And so I would say that the more the Taliban come in and take over areas or have an influence on areas, that a lot of these things will again subside to where they were before.
Ambassador, what are the differences between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that should affect our policy?
That's a basic question that we need to deal with. The Taliban are basically, on the Afghan side, Afghans who are concerned about their nation and not about international terrorism. Al-Qaeda is an internationally based organization which is interested in promoting terrorist actions against the West and against other regimes by terror. And this is legitimately considered a major threat to the United States and our primary concern. So you have to distinguish between a local based group, which is Taliban, and an internationally designed threat, which is Al-Qaeda. Now, we've talked about dealing with Al-Qaeda as our primary goal. Al-Qaeda is, in fact, almost entirely eliminated from Afghanistan. And that's a point that some people forget. And the base and the leadership of Al-Qaeda today is in Pakistan. Pakistan is supposed to be an ally of ours, supposed to be fighting terrorism, and yet they haven't been able to wipe out the leadership of Al-Qaeda in the western tribal areas of their own country. So that's a fundamental issue that we're trying to deal with. President Obama, in his policy statement back in March, on March 27th, where he declared what our strategy is, said first that our strategy was to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan. That's fine as far as it goes, and some people are arguing that we should have limited it to that strategy, that narrower anti-terrorist strategy. However, in his March 27th statement, he went on to add a lot of other goals and made it pretty complicated. He said that we want a stable, competent Afghan government considered legitimate by its people and capable of defending them, so Afghanistan will no longer function as a safe haven for terrorist groups. Now, function as a safe haven for terrorist groups is certainly legitimate in an anti-terrorist policy, but that leads us into nation building. So we have in our policy, which Obama declared in March, we have expanded our goals not just to defeating Al-Qaeda and international terrorism, but to nation building. And so we want this stable Afghan state, an accountable government, a legitimate vote, and there's some problems with that. Mm-hmm. It leads us to trying to deal with Pakistan, as I mentioned earlier, because the Pakistanis are supporting not only Al-Qaeda indirectly, but the Taliban directly. And we have some disagreements with Pakistan over what they're doing and whether they're doing the right thing. We have sent in, for purposes of dealing with the insurgency, that is the Taliban inside of Afghanistan, we've sent in more and more troops, and General McChrystal wants more troops now. If you ask a general what does he need, he'll say he needs more troops, and sure enough, that's what he said. I have some problems, by the way, with the transparency of this discussion that's going on in Washington. But to defeat the insurgency and to stabilize Afghanistan probably would take a lot more troops. Some of the experts argue, and there's a RAND study on this, that to stabilize an unstable government and country from outside, you need to have one soldier for every 50 citizens. Now, in Afghanistan, that would mean 500,000. We've got 68,000. We may go to 100,000 with NATO. That's another 40,000. That isn't 500,000. So if the RAND study is correct, are we heading in the direction of 500,000 troops in order to stabilize Afghanistan from the outside? So that our NATO allies are providing a few troops, but those are dwindling. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do it, they certainly aren't going to do it. We've looked at the Iraq as a model, as a template, and said clear, hold, and build is what we're going to do. So we clear an area with our own troops. We hold it for a little while. But the question is it going to be built by the Afghans when we leave? I'm not at all sure that it is.
Doctor, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing about the difference between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And I think the Taliban, the kind of people that are attracted to the Taliban are different than the ones to Al-Qaeda. Taliban are generally illiterate and unsophisticated and often farmers. And the Taliban is an overall term which covers you know, poor people who want jobs and people who want adventure and people, some ideologues as well. But I think the Pashtuns, and we have to keep emphasizing this, there are 13 million of them in Afghanistan, and there are 28 in Afghanistan. And so the Taliban the Pashtuns see the Taliban as the only way they can regain power that they lost to the Americans in 2001. And so the Pashtuns are willing to support the Taliban, even if they're not ideologues. I think that's an important point because the Al-Qaeda is a smaller group. It takes some effort to get involved with them. They tend to be foreigners and Arabs, which also makes them not as acceptable to the Afghans. And they're educated. They're from, most of them have university degrees or professional degrees. And I want to point out one more thing, that is that we only indirectly became enemies of the Taliban because they harbored Al-Qaeda and refused to give them up. Well, the Taliban were actually, as Pashtuns, they were following their Pashtun Wali code, which says a fugitive always has the right to seek protection, and it's their honor and duty to do it. Now, it's interesting that Pakistan is harboring and refusing to give up these various groups too, and yet instead of punishing them the way we did the Taliban, we're giving them lots of assistance and help. Yeah. And right. What's the difference in my mind?
Right. Sebastian, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, it brought me back to 2001. I remember being on the front lines outside of Kabul, and the enemy positions would speak to each other on the radios, the same frequencies. And so the Northern Alliance fighters I was with were talking with their Taliban counterparts about a mile away, and the American bombers were coming in for another bombing run. And the guys I was with are saying, uh-oh, here they come. You're going to get killed by the American birds, is what they called them. And the Taliban guy was saying, no, we're okay. They're just here to kill the Arabs, and we hate, no one likes the Arabs anyway. Why are they even in our country? And that, to me, was a really interesting insight to this split in Afghanistan. And I think, it's been many years since then, but I think there's still maybe the potential to exploit that split in terms of a political solution in Afghanistan. The Afghans, I don't think, are particularly fond of the Taliban. They're not a particularly popular movement. The real issue, I think, is exactly as has been said, that it's the Pashtun means. It's a tool for Pashtun power, and ultimately the root of all this is that the Pashtuns do not have their own nation. That's a root of all of this conflict, and if somehow they did have their own nation, I think they would see no use at all for having Arab fighters in their midst. I think they would kick them out.
Mm. Let's talk to Pat, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Mindy. I'm loving this discussion. It's so stimulating, and I'm learning so much. My thoughts are, I am British but now living here, so I learnt a lot of history of that area from the British point of view. And basically, the British made the biggest mess in the world because they wanted to impose a way of life and an order that was theirs. And I know the British were responsible for drawing a particular border, which is problematic. Mm-hmm. But do you think it might behoove the president and his advisors to look back at the British mistakes in that area and be informed by them?
That's an intriguing question. What do you think?
I think we've made enough of our own mistakes on top of earlier mistakes. The British, I think, assumed that they could control and influence the Afghans and the Pakistanis much more than they actually did, and we've probably made the same mistakes. We're not going to be able to generate stability and good governance and absence of corruption and all of the other things and democratic government. And we went in right after 9/11, and we helped set up a new government in Afghanistan. And in the beginning, it looked like a successful operation. We brought into power Hamid Karzai, who's a Pashtun, who had the support of the other elements in Afghan society. We worked with the neighbors, with Pakistan, and we worked with Iran. I think there's a lesson there that we can look back to our own successes and our own failures and try to build on our successes. One of the lessons is probably that we ought to be working with Iran. The Iranians benefited from what we did by removing the Taliban from power, and then we turned the other way and called them part of the axis of evil. Mm-hmm. If we try to cooperate with the Iranians, we'll do better. We also need to deal with the Pakistani situation, as I mentioned earlier, and we need to think carefully about what kind of governance that we should support in Afghanistan. It's their country, mm-hmm. and they're going to figure it out themselves. But we ended up supporting the development of a presidential system with national elections, and maybe that isn't appropriate. They've never had a presidential system mm-hmm. like that, and as we saw in the election a few weeks ago, our chosen instrument, Hamid Karzai, rigged the election. Apparently, we don't know yet, but the election results are still not in. Because there's so many complaints about rigging the election. So it's gone wrong.
Right.
And he has failed to gain support throughout the country. He has failed to provide services.
On that?
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead, Pat. What?
I was saying, may I come back on that?
Go ahead.
I'm referring to, right now I'm referring to a discussion that came earlier, which to me centered around hearts and minds. And knowing your neighbor, knowing the people of Afghanistan, mm-hmm. knowing the tribal systems, understanding the way of life, which it seems to me has not been and is only slightly being addressed now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, basically, it's showing bare chests.
Right.
That, to me, we can't just go in, and yes, sir, you have addressed that, go in with our own system and just plonk it on top and say, you will do this.
And I know that Dr. Rue would like to comment on that. Pat, thanks for the call.
Okay. Well, as Bill said, the Afghans have always had a weak, decentralized state where the ruler essentially governed a confederation of tribes and ethnic groups, and he did it through consultation and consensus. And once he made a decision, everybody supported him. The Afghans are not really used to this kind of election system, which is divisive. It pits factions against factions. And if I could give you an anecdote from my own experience out working in Pashtun areas, I also worked in Baluch areas. And in the Pakistan bureaucracy, which is very different from the Baluch bureaucracy, traditionally, there's almost no differentiation of status. So in the NWFP, for example, it was very difficult to find anyone who would make definitive decisions because they didn't want to get out in front of each other. Now, we complain about Karzai and his lack of providing services, etc. But I would say a lot of this comes from the way he approaches bureaucracy. As I noted in the Pashtun areas, our office letters always started with, I've been asked to inform you, because everybody wants to avoid responsibility being the one who makes the decision that aggravates other people. So there's a kind of natural egalitarianism in tribal society where you try to pull people together in alliances and develop, bring everybody into the shared kind of responsibility. And I later, maybe you'd let me talk about the things I think Karzai has reverted to in the traditional system that makes him feel more comfortable with the government, the centralized government that we've imposed upon him.
We're talking about the war in Afghanistan with retired Ambassador William Rue, anthropologist and author Andrea Rue, and journalist and author Sebastian Younger. Our toll-free number, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Sebastian, I'm going to go back to you were embedded in Afghanistan, but you talked to a lot of soldiers who served both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I'm wondering what they have to say about the differences of the wars in both countries.
Well, I mean, I hope this isn't too shocking, but frontline soldiers really, they joined those units. They joined combat units because they wanted to fight. The combat is a very intense experience, and if you're in the airborne infantry, you fought to get into that unit. You had to pass a lot of tests precisely because you wanted the experience of combat. And so the problem with Iraq is that there was, from the soldier's perspective, is that there was very little combat, although there was a lot of danger in roadside bombs, which the soldiers considered to be kind of not a fair way of fighting. Combat, on the other hand, is something that you have a say. You have a say in the outcome because it's actually a bit of a chess game between one side and the other. And so the soldiers all thought of Afghanistan as the place where you could get your CIB, your combat infantry badge. A lot of the guys in Iraq apparently were desperate to get to Afghanistan because there was actual fighting there. You know, of course, once they got there, it was a pretty heavy situation, and some of them really didn't want to be there any longer than necessary. But the difference, at least in the area where I was in the northeast of the country, in Kunar province, is that it really was kind of old-fashioned warfare. I mean, the guys, you know, had 100-plus pounds on their back. They would go on patrol. They would set up ambushes. They would get ambushed. They would dig trenches and get in them and shoot. It really sometimes looked, just visually, it looked like Vietnam or World War II. It was a pretty extraordinary thing to see.
Yeah, that's what sort of struck me when I looked at some of the video, and I found it interesting, Sebastian, that the most of them that you talked to, you know, you would think, oh boy, what have I got myself into? I'm sorry I did this, but that's not the sentiment you were getting from them. They were not thinking they made the wrong decision.
No, they wanted. I mean, the fact that you might die is a terrifying idea to anybody. It's even more terrifying if you have no say in the matter, and that's how they understood. That's how they thought of the roadside bombs. At least in combat, if you're a good unit, you can fight back effectively and increase your chance of survival. If you're a bad unit, you have a greater chance of being killed. And so, in that, they felt that they had some control. And that's where I hate to use this phrase, but it's pretty applicable. That's where the thrill of combat comes in. It's the thrill of mastering a very scary, difficult skill and surviving. And that was endlessly addictive to the young men that I was with.
Yeah. Let's talk to Dana, who's giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Dana.
Hi. Good morning to all of you. That's a little scary, what I just heard, but... Mm-hmm. My own point was, I'd like to comment on the way media coverage of this war. I appreciate your guests pointing out the complexities of how the social and cultural issues play out in Afghanistan, the political issues play out in Afghanistan. But it just seems like on NPR programs from Washington, it's always an article of faith that America's doing the right thing, that we have a right to invade and occupy that land, and it's always a good guys, bad guys scenario that they point out, and you show me that it's, you've made it evident that it's not that simple. And what I also think is singularly lacking is in this coverage is movements that are opposed to the United States being there that don't like the Taliban either, or don't like Al-Qaeda, but they don't want us there either. Mm-hmm. And that maybe the military... this heavy-handed military response is not the answer. I'm not claiming to know myself, but it just looks like a pattern that we've had since the end of World War II of the United States from Korea right up to Iraq and Afghanistan, invading and occupying countries ostensibly for national security.
Right. Well, but, Dana, thanks for your thoughts on that. We appreciate it. Does anybody want to comment on that? Go ahead, Dr. Ambassador Rue.
I think Dana is absolutely right that our first of all, our media coverage is inadequate. CNN a few weeks ago did a program, hour-long program by Christiane Amanpour on Afghanistan, and she showed American soldiers in full combat gear handing out pens and pencils to children to persuade them to love us and want us to stay. That's a very superficial view of what's going on in the minds of the Afghans, and we need to get beyond that superficiality. We're not going to change the world with pens and pencils. But the other question is the role of the Taliban and Al Qaeda. If I could come back to that for a minute. There's a buried in the initial strategy paper that the president put out back in March is a comment about that I found interesting and maybe an opening for something that I wish he would do. He talks about, and I think it's only one sentence, but he talks about, in effect, co-opting the Taliban and the insurgents to the extent that we can and separating them out from the violent, extremist, ideological ones like Mullah Omar and the leadership, and in effect splitting the insurgency. Now, that makes sense. And if you're going to have a long-term strategy of dealing with counterterrorism and doing what you can, and it's limited, doing what you can to help build the nation, I think trying to split the Taliban makes a lot of sense, in addition to dealing with the Pakistani problem with the Taliban. And if we do that, and if we focus on our counter-terrorism strategy, I think we have some hope of moving in the right direction. We don't know what the president is going to decide. Mm-hmm. Although there's been a remarkable amount of leakage, and the press seems to have figured out that Joe Biden wants to do one thing and Hillary Clinton wants to do another thing, that's amazing to me. As a former government official and diplomat, I'm astounded that we know so much. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we should know so much, because it's the president's – you're tying the president's hands if you bring the public into it before he's decided on a strategy. In fact, I think he ordered the increase in troops before he had a clear strategy. Mm-hmm. And now I hope he gets the strategy right and then decides. And to say a final word on Dana's point, there is no military solution to this problem. It's got to be political, diplomatic, and economic, and with social issues in mind.
I want to ask a question here, and I'm not sure who I'm asking this of, maybe Sebastian or Ambassador. There are many critics who say the war in Afghanistan is turning into another Vietnam. Is that an appropriate analogy?
Can I jump in?
Sure.
Sebastian here. I mean, in some ways, it's a sort of facile analogy. In Vietnam, we lost almost 60,000 men. Last year in Afghanistan, I think we lost 150. So there are maybe political and strategic relationships, but the scale, the magnitude of the war in Vietnam absolutely dwarfs this one, at least in terms of casualties. But just to go back for a moment to the makeup of the Taliban, which I think is extremely important. Mm-hmm. I would say about two-thirds of the fighters in the Korangal Valley, where I was, were locals. They're local boys who were paid $5 a day and essentially didn't have much else to do. And they were hired by local Afghan Taliban groups who were much more hardcore and had a lot of financial interests tied up in the poppy trade or the illegal timber trade. They were basically mafias with a political agenda. And those, in turn, were supported by the Pakistani Taliban, and interwoven into there was Al-Qaeda. And what I found, what would happen is that there'd be a big firefight in the Korangal Valley, a valley-wide fight. It would go on for half an hour, an hour. after that, there wouldn't even be a single rifle shot, or a single gunshot for a week or two, because the local fighters had shot off all of their ammunition, and it would take 2 weeks for them to carry more ammo from Pakistan into the Korangal Valley. And when the ammo got there, there would be another valley-wide firefight. And in my, maybe this is very naive and simplistic, but in my mind, I thought, why are we even here? We need to be on the border, because without that inflow of ammunition, there literally is no, there is no war. There is no fight in this country if we can block that border. I know it's naive, but it was a hard thought to not, a hard conclusion not to come to.
You're nodding your head, Ambassador.
Yeah, I think it's great that Sebastian has had this experience on the ground and has seen the realities of Afghanistan, because we're getting a better picture from people like him. If you don't parachute in and do a story in 24 hours and get out, but stay there for a while, you can really see what's happening. And he's done a terrific job in describing what it's like to be a soldier in mm-hmm. Afghanistan. But I think he's also got some insights into the problem of American intervention. And I thought we had learned in Iraq that American military solutions to a political problem don't necessarily work. But I'm afraid President Obama has gotten trapped into trying to carry out our policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan using military tools. We may find out in a couple of days when he announces his policy that he has a different approach, and I hope that's the case. But as I say, there is no military solution. We've got to follow a different course. And unfortunately, last March, he set us off in a nation-building and broad goals course that I hope he's not stuck with, because I think it needs to be reconsidered.
I have about a minute left. I'm going to give final word to you, Dr. Rue.
Well, in relation to Sebastian's point, what frightens me a little bit is this major increase in police and army with training from the U.S., because in the long run, Afghanistan cannot support a large army like that. I mean, if some of the numbers are correct, we'd be asking them to pay 500 per times the current budget to support these people, and we're giving them more lethal arms and techniques, which it seems that it'll only make the tribal battles and the other conflicts within the country more lethal and terrible to deal with.
Dr. Andrea Rue, Ambassador William Rue, and author and journalist Sebastian Younger, thank you all for being with us this morning and sharing your insights into this war. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point with Mindy Todd is made possible in part by South Mountain Company, an employee-owned firm designing and building for the future since 1975. Houses, neighborhoods, and clean energy for Martha's Vineyard and beyond. Online at southmountain.com.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Naomi Ehrenberg and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.